Today is Monday, April 5th, and you are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chino Dorfo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, U.S. and Iran set to begin indirect nuclear talks.
These talks will be structured around working groups that the EU is going to form with the remaining partners in the JCPOA, including Iran.
Also, week two of the George Floyd trial.
I expect the defense will also be contesting that question of behavior and the standards of conduct and just how much force was necessary.
Plus, Eritrean forces are withdrawing from the Tigray region. These stories and more are next. Iran and the United States will begin indirect talks in Vienna Tuesday as part of a broader negotiations to revive the 2015 nuclear deal between Tehran and global powers. Tehran has ruled out face-to-face bilateral discussions, but the presence of both Iran and the United States in the Austrian capital, welcomed by Washington as a, quote, healthy step forward, unquote, will help to focus efforts to bring all sides back into compliance with the accord. The aim is to reach an agreement within 2 months, said a senior official with the European Union, which is coordinating the deal. Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled out of the nuclear pact in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran, prompting it to violate some of the accord's nuclear restrictions. His successor, Joe Biden, wants to revive the agreement, but Washington and Tehran have been at odds over who should take the first step. Iran, China, Russia, France, Germany, and Britain, all parties to the 2015 deal, held virtual talks on Friday to see how to proceed. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
We are very clear-eyed about the hurdles that remain. These talks will be structured around working groups that the EU is going to form with the remaining partners in the JCPOA, including Iran. And the primary issues that will be discussed are the nuclear steps that Iran would need to take in order to return to compliance with the JCPOA and the sanctions relief steps the United States would need to take in order to return to compliance as well. We don't anticipate presently that there will be direct talks between the United States and Iran through the process, though we certainly remain open to them.
That's White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. The Kremlin said its troop movement near the Ukraine border are no threat to anyone. Reuters reports that Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov Monday said Russia is looking out for its own security. Last week, Peskov said Russia may be forced to take, quote, additional steps, unquote, if the U.S. or NATO were to increase their presence near Russia's border in response to recent escalation in hostilities in eastern Ukraine. On Friday, U.S. President Joe Biden affirmed his, quote, unwavering support for Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity in the face of Russia's ongoing aggression, unquote, following a phone call with Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky. Russia has consistently denied having military presence in the Donbass region. U.S. President Joe Biden recently announced a $2 trillion spending plan aimed at modernizing the nation's roads and bridges, among other infrastructure. The plan, however, is expected to face obstacles in Congress. VOA's Michelle Quinn reports.
It's time to build our economy from the bottom up.
President Biden's proposed infrastructure plan paints a broad picture of what counts as infrastructure. It's not just for fixing roads and bridges, but for building out broadband internet and technology to mitigate climate change.
In my view, this is a once-in-a-lifetime moment. I don't think in the next 50 years we're going to see another time when we have this combination of a demonstrated need, bipartisan interest, widespread impatience, and a very supportive president who is committed, by the way, not just to the infrastructure itself, but to the jobs we're going to create.
The package's jobs plan includes building the nation's clean energy workforce and boosting caregiving as a profession. Republican leaders say the proposal is too big. The package envisions a network of 500,000 electric car charging stations by 2030.
When people think about infrastructure, they're thinking about roads, bridges, ports, and airports. That's a very small part of what they're calling an infrastructure package.
Paying for the bill is also an issue. The package proposes tax increases on corporations, which Republicans say they oppose. The bill is now being taken up by Congress, with Democratic leaders aiming to get it to the president's desk for a signature in the coming months. The package will be a test of the Democratic Party's unity. If Biden can't get support from any Republicans, he will need every Democrat to vote for it in the evenly divided Senate. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg says he thinks he can get Republicans on board with the president's $2.3 trillion infrastructure bill, but some GOPers say the way to do that is limited to infrastructure. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
Republican Senator Roy Blunt says he's told the White House,
"You've got an easy bipartisan win here if you'll keep this package narrowly focused on infrastructure."
He says that's roads, bridges, airports, etc., but instead 70% is not core infrastructure, like $174 billion for electric vehicle charging stations. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg argues people drive electric cars on the road.
Infrastructure investment has to include looking to the future. Railroads seemed futuristic, and then we actually built them. Now they're considered traditional infrastructure.
Both made their comments on ABC's This Week. I'm Julie Walker.
Prosecutors and defense made their case in the first week of the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former police officer charged in the death of an African-American man, George Floyd. As the world watched, witnesses gave a series of compelling and very emotional testimonies. Legal analysts say This Week could even be more dramatic, as the list of witnesses include the chief of police and medical examiners. For more, I spoke with former prosecutor and criminal defense attorney Jack Rice.
The prosecution has been doing a very good job this first week. They've focused on putting on a lot of eyewitnesses, those people who saw what they saw in the streets on the 25th of May in South Minneapolis. They put a lot of people on and they showed a lot of video. That which didn't surprise me was that even during the opening statements themselves, the prosecutor in this case put on that 8-minute and 46-second video that really spread across the world. And I think that was designed to be a foundation for the rest of this trial. And I think it had a real impact upon the jury.
What about the defense? What do you think are the high points of their argument?
When we look at where the defense is right now, what they're really trying to argue, and they're going to be doing this not as much as effectively as they have this week, but probably next week and the week thereafter, is what they're trying to argue is that George Floyd had some serious heart conditions, which is true, and even the state has acknowledged those issues. He had serious opioid issues. That was also true. On the date of offense, he was actually chewing up methamphetamine and fentanyl in his system, which can actually cause death itself. And finally, also that George Floyd was actually fighting the police up until the point where he was put on the ground by those police officers. So really the argument, simply put by the defense, is that it wasn't Derek Chauvin that killed George Floyd. It was George Floyd's behavior and his pre-existing conditions that really made this happen. It's a tall order. It's going to be somewhat difficult for the defense, and they're in a very difficult place right now. But I think that seems to be what the arguments that they intend to make.
From your experience, is the defense shooting for an outright acquittal, or they're just trying to putting some doubts in the minds of the jury?
It's a great question. I think it's difficult for the defense in a case like this because of the amount of video and some of the really compelling statements being made here. I think we should also add that in the wake of George Floyd's death last May, there were really incredible riots in Minneapolis and St. Paul and some even around the country. And even around the world, there are more than 1,600 buildings that were burned here in these cities. And I think that is having an impact upon this jury as well. Nevertheless, what the defense is really working on right now is I think it's unlikely that they may get an acquittal, although they may be able to acquit on the most serious second-degree unintentional murder charge. But I think they're also looking for potentially something called a hung jury in the United States, which means that you're not going to get all of those jurors to agree, because in the U.S., you need a unanimous jury in order to convict here, and they're trying to get that in that third-degree murder charge and maybe even that manslaughter charge.
With the stakes so high and the trial resuming on Monday, what do you expect?
What we saw in the last 2 days of trial this week were people from the Minneapolis Police Department trying to establish what the standard of behavior is and should be for their police officers. And in fact, one of the things that they said that really stuck out to me from one of the detectives in this case is that the use of a technique where you put an officer puts their knee on the neck of somebody who's detained is, quote unquote, totally unnecessary. That's the standard that they're trying to make. They're going to continue to really work that point. I'm sure that the chief of the Minneapolis Police Department, Chief Arredondo, will testify on probably Monday or Tuesday at latest. And so I expect to see the prosecution continue down that path. They will then start to turn to other experts, including medical examiners, to look at autopsy reports. There's going to be a huge fight when it comes to that issue down the road. Plus, I expect the defense will also be contesting that question of behavior and the standards of conduct and just how much force was necessary based upon the circumstances in this case. So it's going to be a very busy week next week.
That's from a prosecutor and criminal defense attorney, Jack Rice, speaking with me from Minneapolis. Eritrean forces have started withdrawing from the Tigray region in northern Ethiopia, the Ethiopian Foreign Ministry said, following mounting reports blaming the Eritreans for human rights abuses, including rape, looting, and killing of civilians. This report, produced by Yahaira Jacques of Reuters.
The Ethiopian Foreign Ministry said Eritrean forces have started withdrawing from the Tigray region in northern Ethiopia, following mounting reports blaming the Eritreans for human rights abuses, including rape, looting, and killings of civilians. The United States, Germany, France, and other G7 countries this week called for a swift and verifiable withdrawal of the Eritrean troops, followed by a political process acceptable to all Ethiopians. For months, Eritrea and Ethiopia denied the presence of Eritrean troops, despite dozens of eyewitness accounts. Just last month, Ethiopia's Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, acknowledged their presence, while Eritrea has still not said its soldiers are there. Ethiopia sent its troops to Tigray in November to fight against the TPLF, then the regional ruling party, which had attacked army bases in the region. In late November, the TPLF withdrew and the Ethiopian government declared victory. Electricity and phone connections to Tigray have been down for the past 4 days, making it difficult to verify any Eritrean withdrawal. Thousands of people have been killed in the conflict, hundreds of thousands have been forced from their homes, and there are shortages of food, water, and medicine in the region.
That's Yahaira Jacques of Reuters. People in England will be offered free rapid COVID-19 tests twice a week as part of plans to further ease Britain's lockdown and open shops, pubs, and restaurants. Flora Bradley-Watson of Reuters reports.
As the British government prepares to further ease lockdown restrictions, everyone in England is to be offered regular tests for COVID-19. Under plans due to be announced on Monday, people will be entitled to take a rapid test twice a week to prevent outbreaks and find those not displaying symptoms. Prime Minister Boris Johnson is also expected to confirm that non-essential shops, outdoor hospitality, and hairdressers can reopen on April the 12th. He will also give more details on proposed vaccine passports and international travel. In a statement, Johnson said, quote, "As we continue to make good progress on our vaccine program and with our roadmap to cautiously easing restrictions underway, regular rapid testing is even more important to make sure those efforts aren't wasted." The UK has pulled off one of the world's most successful vaccination campaigns. More than half the adult population has been given either an AstraZeneca or Pfizer vaccine shot. It's meant that the UK is able to relax its rules, while across the Channel in Europe, countries are tightening theirs. But Britain still remains one of the worst hit by the pandemic. It's recorded almost 127,000 deaths, the fifth highest death toll in the world. In 2020, its GDP fell by 9.8%, the most in more than three centuries, and one of the deepest contractions in the world.
Also in the UK, British police said that 107 people were arrested in London during demonstrations against government plans to increase police powers. AP correspondent Zaya Sheckley reports.
Thousands marched in towns and cities across the country on Saturday to protest the police crime sentencing and courts bill, defying coronavirus restrictions. Police said the Kill the Bill protests were mostly peaceful and most of those taking part observed social distancing. They said a small number of people were intent on causing disruptions. They said that those arrested committed alleged offences including violent disorder, assaulting police officers and breaches of coronavirus legislation. The police said 10 officers had been injured, though none of the injuries was believed to be serious. Zaria Shackley, London.
This is the Voice of America. At least 55 people were killed in flash floods and landslides in a cluster of islands of southwest Indonesia on Sunday, the country's National Disaster Agency said. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has appeared in a court for the resumption of his corruption trial. The evidentiary phase of the trial begins on Monday as Israel's political parties meet with the president to weigh in on who should form the next government following last month's inconclusive elections. Turkish authorities have detained 10 former admirals after more than 100 retired naval officers issued a midnight statement that government officials said evoked Turkey's history of military coups. In the statement, the 103 retired admirals declared their commitment to an international treaty that regulates shipping through the Bosphorus and the Dardanelles Straits. The statement triggered strong condemnation from ruling party and government officials, who drew a parallel with statements that have accompanied past military takeovers in Turkey. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Junaid Wolfo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Hundreds of civilians in Myanmar, including activists, members of former de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy, and villagers in the ethnic areas being bombed by the military, have gone into hiding. Some are seeking refuge in Kayen State, but in Thailand. It is a region controlled by the Karen National Union, an ethnic armed organization that is no stranger to conflict, having been fighting for greater autonomy in Myanmar for more than seven decades. Steve Sanford reports from Mae Sot, Thailand.
Here in Mae Sot, signs of increased security can be seen along the border as the conflict escalates across the river in Myanmar's Kayin State. Thousands of civilians have gone into hiding as government forces continue a brutal crackdown on the civilian population, including indiscriminate air attacks. For some migrants, like this former Karen soldier whose working wife is stranded in Yangon with two children, the daily updates from home are distressing.
My family's in danger. Outside our apartment building, the Burmese authorities watch us and use slingshots to smash windows on the building. And they arrest people because the Burmese authorities don't want them to resist.
Some exiles, like Miatu, a former member of the All Burma Students Democratic Front, fled the country after the 1988 uprising, when the military cracked down on anti-government demonstrations, killing hundreds of protesters. It has been 30 years since Miatu took up arms with ethnic armies in Kayin State, but the former activist still volunteers advice to all who face persecution by the coup leaders.
I suggest those people in danger to contact nearest ethnic arms groups, which I think is very, very safe for them to hide at the moment.
Despite international condemnation, Myanmar's forces continue brutal attacks on unarmed civilians as the death toll mounts. That's why the Karen National Union is getting set to provide sanctuary for fleeing Myanmar citizens of all ethnic nationalities.
We have prepared the land to accommodate the people who are fleeing to a safe place in our Karen area, more than 400 acres of Myanmar exiles.
As the Myanmar army continues a vicious crackdown on civilians, the number of those fleeing to the border is expected to rise. Steve Sanford for VOA News, Mae Sot, Thailand.
Jordan's Deputy Prime Minister Ayan Safadi says that King Abdullah's half-brother and former Crown Prince, Prince Hamza, liaised with foreign parties over a plot to destabilize the country. Hamza, an outspoken critic of corruption in Jordan, had called for holding those responsible for graft to account. Some analysts say the opposition is not to the government, but to economic, political, and social policies adopted by the king. Dave Gavlak reports from Amman.
Division in Jordan's ruling royal family erupted into the open late Saturday when Prince Hamza, King Abdullah's younger half-brother, announced he could not leave his home, and state media reported that senior officials had been detained in a security probe. Hamza sent a video recording to the BBC saying he was being silenced and lashed out at authorities, saying the country had become stymied in corruption, nepotism, and misrule. Jordan's military told Hamza to stop activities targeting the country's stability and security. While those actions were not publicly spelled out, Army Chief Youssef Haneti denied reports that Hamza had been arrested. Jordanian analyst Labib Kamhawi explains what may have led to actions taken against Hamza.
His latest campaign in visiting various tribes, which the king believes Jordan tribes are the base of his power and the source of all the personnel of the security establishment, the armed forces, the intelligence. So he looked at Hamza's attempt to penetrate these tribes as being a direct threat to his power base. What the king did is to preempt things and simply put an end to Hamza's campaign, and at the same time, he gave a clear signal to all the opposition in Jordan that my tolerance has a limit. Even my brother had to pay for opposing me and my policies.
Hamza is the eldest son of American-born Queen Noor and the late King Hussein. After Hussein's death in 1999, Abdullah ascended to the throne and named Hamza as crown prince. 5 years later, Abdullah stripped him of the title. The position would have put Hamza next in line for the throne. Abdullah named his eldest son, Hussein, as crown prince. Jordanian analyst Amr Essebaili says the country's security apparatus, along with the United States and regional powers, all express firm support for King Abdullah, but that the incident points to unprecedented public fractures within the royal family.
Politically, the real danger is in opening the door for competition within the throne itself. This criticism among the family itself, this has never happened in Jordan. But other than that, I cannot see really any threat that can make me feel concerned.
The coronavirus pandemic has severely impacted the economy of Jordan, a resource-poor nation dependent on foreign aid, which also shelters more than 1.5 million refugees from neighboring conflicts. Kamhawi and other observers say they believe that Abdullah's tolerance of overtures by Hamza and his associates to dissident tribesmen and opposition figures had worn thin. So the king decided to act, signaling, be careful, there should be a limit to what you do. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
Prince Hamza said in a voice recording released on Monday that he will disobey orders from the army not to communicate with the outside world after he was put under house arrest and accused of trying to destabilize the country. The half-brother of King Abdullah and former heir to the throne said in the recording, which the opposition released, that he would not comply after being barred from any activity and told to keep quiet. A Swiss startup is looking to boost confidence in the safety of air travel during the coronavirus pandemic by using decades-old technology. VOA's Arash Al-Abbasadi shines light on this story.
A virus-killing robot roams the aisles of an airplane in Zurich. The robot must operate without a human to deliver its waves of ultraviolet light. UVA co-founder Jodak Elmiser explains.
It's quite an old technology, but it's quite dangerous. That's why we want to take the worker out of the range of the light. So that's why we made a robot.
Excess exposure to ultraviolet or UV radiation can cause cancers in humans. But UVA's founders say the decades-old UVC technology delivered by the autonomous robot has the upside of killing the coronavirus. Elmiser says using light to sanitize a plane is safer than cleaning solutions.
UVC doesn't make any traces or chemistry, so that's also very important for the traveler, that you know that you have a safe place and there is no chemical residue on the seats or everywhere.
One robot can disinfect an entire single-aisle airplane in 13 minutes. That's welcome news for Swiss regional airline Helvetic Airways, says spokesman Mehdi Gönen.
As an airline, at the moment, it's really important that we can restore the confidence in air travel. So if our passengers, if our crew know our aircraft is safe, there is no viruses, no bacteria, it could help to fly again and to have a good feeling to fly again.
The U.S. Food and Drug Administration says UVC radiation is a known disinfectant for air, water, and non-porous surfaces, but can be blocked by something as simple as dust. UVA currently has 3 robot prototypes and recently demonstrated one of them at the Zurich airport, where traffic dropped 75% last year. Arash Al-Abbasadi, VOA News.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening.